What's so special about October 11th, 1974? That day marks the release of both Black Christmas and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Together, these films help launch a cinematic phenomenon, the slasher. Each uses some key features of what would become tenets of the subgenre. Both have human killers, obscured faces, slow and gory deaths, victims picked off one by one, and a genre favorite, the final girl. These gory inceptions are hardly the beginning or the end of the subgenre.
And action.
But one thing is for sure, slashers are built on tropes. Rules were made to be broken, at least in fiction.
Cut.
And we're going to cover them all. From proto-slasher to the current neo-slasher renaissance, this is everything you need to know about slashers. This is an episode on slasher films. Believe it or not, there will be blood. Viewer discretion is advised. The proto-slasher period of the 1960s to late 1970s established the roots of many slasher tropes. These horror films introduced elements that evolved into slasher canon. Let's start in 1960 with Peeping Tom.
Mark, what do you do?
Obsessive wannabe filmmaker Mark uses a blade hidden in the leg of his tripod to brutally murder multiple women. Mark records his victims' deaths, which the audience sees through his camera lens, an early version of the point-of-view kill. Another early proto-slasher trope carried over into an iconic film released the same year, Psycho. Alfred Hitchcock's classic features a generationally traumatized and psychologically damaged knife-wielding killer, Norman Bates.
We all go a little mad sometimes.
As well as his voyeuristic peephole. Shots that, like those in Peeping Tom, are from the killer's point of view. That these films inextricably entwine sex to violence feels obvious, but the way the subgenre continues to explore this theme evolves with nuance. Symbolically, Norman is alone with his trauma.
We're all in our private traps.
Hiding behind a mask of a handsome face and a polite demeanor.
I think I must have one of those faces you just can't help believing.
Capitalizing on the new popularity of gore, legendary Italian auteur Mario Bava jumped from gothic horror films into the burgeoning slasher subgenre when he made A Bay of Blood in 1971. Bava's graphic on-screen approach to combining sex and death became a slasher trademark, as does the group of teenage victims. In 1973's Torso, the victims are still young, but this time all females. They are stalked in a remote location by a masked misogynist who was traumatized by childhood loss. All of these films helped lay the foundation for the birth of the slasher.
Hello?
In Black Christmas, sorority sisters isolated in their house during the Christmas holiday are terrorized by an anonymous man with menacing phone calls as he stalks them silently throughout the house.
He's expanded his act.
The opening shot is from the point of view of an unidentified threat climbing up to the sorority house's attic and immediately lets the audience know that these women are in danger. Bad things are coming. It's an iconic scene that firms up the first of our slasher rules. Rule 1, a killer's POV. The use of a voyeuristic point of view shot from the killer's perspective appears again and again in slasher films. It's often accompanied with heavy breathing or hearing the heartbeat of the killer. This storytelling device slows down the pace and heightens suspense. An attack feels imminent. The POV shot forces the viewer to take on the role of the killer, which is unsettling, and keeps us close to the inescapable violence. Flipping our first rule on its head, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre uses POV shots from the victims. The victims are a group of young, free-willing road trippers in a remote farmland, with literally no one around and no one to help. Their every attempt to escape thwarted. Rule 2, isolated victims. In slashers, it's generally a bad idea to split up. Death comes when the victim or victim duo are separated from the others. Being isolated and alone increases vulnerability and the killer's control. Texas Chainsaw Massacre's masked killer Leatherface takes some inspiration from real serial killer Ed Gein. One of the items recovered from his home was a mask made from human skin. Gene's unassuming life living on a farm made the heartland and other typically benign Americana more threatening, something a cannibal family in Texas would gruesomely deliver on. Psycho's Norman Bates also borrowed from Gene's crimes, personality, and obsession with his mother. It's a reflection from real life and another key element in slashers. Rule 3, human killer.
The killer is someone who is human or was once human.
That's Steve Jones, who leads the horror studies research group at Northumbria University.
It's different from other horror subgenres that are usually defined by the monsters that inhabit those subgenres, like the zombie film or the vampire film or the werewolf film. The slasher is its own particular antagonist type.
The explicitly human slasher killer is a perversion of the familiarity of our everyday lives. This is especially true when the slasher's motivation is revealed to be psychological trauma or extreme circumstances outside their control. But it also makes them more vulnerable. Hypothetically, a slasher can be killed since they are made of the same flesh and bone as their victims.
Steven, I don't think that's what happened.
These early slasher films helped sculpt the subgenre even before it had a proper name, but what it didn't have yet was a bona fide hit, something that was not only commercially profitable, but also critically applauded. That is, until John Carpenter's Halloween, which began the slasher boom. Released just before the October holiday in 1978, Halloween is widely considered the first true slasher, and its critical and commercial success legitimized the genre. The iconic opening shot ticks multiple slasher boxes. We have a POV shot, this time through the eyes of a mask. The scene's ending reveals the killer to be a young boy, Michael Myers. The plot of Halloween follows high school babysitter Laurie Strode as she's stalked by Michael, who is now an adult and recently escaped a mental facility. In his pursuit, Michael murders several people in Laurie's orbit, including a family dog. Another trope appears. Rule 4, killing spree. The killer in a slasher movie murders a lot of people, often driven by some kind of trauma-induced revenge. As the body count builds, the helplessness of authorities to intervene and catch the killer escalates potential victims' fears. In Halloween, Michael dons a pale mask and follows Laurie throughout the movie. She spots him a few times in the daytime as he watches her at school and outside her house. He also stalks Tommy, the child she is set to babysit. As he appears more and more frequently, Laurie becomes increasingly freaked out and paranoid. Michael is methodical and calculating in his pursuit. This is another hallmark of the slasher. Rule 5, the killer stalks the victims. Being followed by an unseen person is obviously unnerving. That persistent sense of dread and tension wears on you, even just as an audience member. Encouraged by the success of Halloween, the 1980s produced more and more slasher films. 1980's Friday the 13th is set at isolated Camp Crystal Lake, the site of a horrible tragedy 30 years prior, when a young Jason Voorhees drowned while the counselors meant to be watching him are teenagers being teenagers. A new group of young adults arrive at Camp Crystal Lake, tasked with reopening the camp, and are picked off by an ambiguous killer triggered to rampage, maybe by the reopening of the camp, maybe by the group's continued sexual encounters, or maybe simply revenge. Either way, all but one of the group die. Rule 6. A homogenous group of young adults. The killer is driven by a desire to kill a certain group that shares similar characteristics.
You should totally come over for a sleepover.
Or that is brought together by a particular event.
Just do it.
Sometimes this is a sorority or fraternity. It may even be a holiday or special event. Or at a school dance like in Prom Night and The Prowler.
Roy?
The characters are generally depicted as free from adult supervision, like summer camps, parties, hazing events, or road trips. This isolation increases their vulnerability and sets the stage for the killer to strike without intervention. It also makes it easier to indulge in behaviors that might be deemed inappropriate by these adults. Activities like partying, drinking, and having sex are common. We get character types like the stoner, the jester, the jock, the flirt, the bully, and the bookworm. The so-called bad archetypes in that list are more likely to die by the end of the film. So there is a bit of moralizing element to these slashers, even if it is tongue-in-cheek.
I'll kill you if this is a joke.
It adds to the formulaic nature of the subgenre and gives a knowledgeable audience an idea of who's next on the kill list. What isn't a good indicator? The whole if you have sex, you die thing. Sorry, Randy. That common adage is more about academic interpretation of slasher films rather than narrative reality. For all genders, a much better predictor of being killed off is nudity, not sexual behavior. But there's plenty of that, especially in this early slasher boom. Friday the 13th's climactic reveal is that Pamela Voorhees, mother of the drowning victim Jason, is the killer.
Jason was my son.
The grieving and vengeful Pamela is also the first female slasher killer, and it's meant to be a shock. Any glimpses of the killer prior to the reveal are gender ambiguous. Her mask is her gender, hiding behind concern and matronly stereotypes to lure her victims and the audience into a false sense of security. In death, Mrs. Voorhees transforms back to a maternal figure, worthy of Jason's vengeance in sequels and remakes.
Jason, mother is talking to you.
Jason takes the idea of masking a lot further, donning the first physical mask of the franchise in Friday the 13th 2, a burlap sack. The now iconic hockey mask doesn't appear until the third movie in the franchise. And this brings us to another well-established trope in slasher lore. Rule 7, a masked killer. Slasher movies love a killer with a mask. The slasher is hidden not only from the characters, but from the audience as well. It keeps us guessing who the killer is. While Jason's hockey mask might be instantly iconic, there are earlier examples, of course. Torso's terrifying ski mask, Leatherface's extra layer of skin, and Michael's pale plastic face. A physical mask can be particularly effective because it makes it easier to imagine our own nightmares hidden under the disguise. Anyone could pick up the mask and become the killer, making their identity even more nebulous. The killer could be anyone at any time.
Everybody's a suspect!
By the time the mid-1980s rolled around, the slasher craze and its mask killers were in full swing.
You have this groundswell of like low budget slasher films being made, and it seemed like there was a slasher film coming out every weekend for about a 2 or 3 year period.
That's Ashley Blackwell, professor, writer, and creator of Graveyard Shift Sisters.
Everyone was going to the theater every weekend, knowing what they were going to see, kind of having a good idea of the formula of what was going to happen. Bunch of teenagers partying, doing whatever, and then most of them get slaughtered.
But what made these films a hit? One reason was the growing economic power of teen audiences, with their part-time jobs and extra cash to spend. Slashers could be easy cash grabs, made for cheap and gobbled up by eager audiences. Slasher films may emphasize the more dangerous things young adults engage in, but they also serve as narratives that appeal to teen rebellion. For example, the removal of parents, families, and frankly, responsible adults from the bulk of their plots.
Where adults do appear in the slasher film, they tend to be ineffective. Either ignore the pleas of the young people who are trying to get them to believe that there's a slasher stalking and killing them, or the adults themselves are killed off.
The studios began to market slasher films to younger audiences. Filmmakers sought to expand viewership beyond young males, but still appease the MPAA and avoid a restrictive X rating. Independent producers and studios had to toe the line with the popular sex and violence storylines teens were drawn to. So maybe there was a bit less gore, but it opened up opportunities to include themes like female bonding, dating, and coming-of-age events. In other words, these films surprisingly had a lot of non-violent content at the core of their narratives.
Gee, that's swell. Soda pop.
One of my favorite things that slasher films have done as far as like critiquing our social cultural or social political world is the idea of teen angst or the whole coming of age story about growing up, about the anxieties about growing up.
Thanks for sticking around.
Take Terror Train. Released in 1980 and starring slasher veteran Jamie Lee Curtis, a group of friends and fraternity brothers gather on a train for a costume party to celebrate New Year's Eve and Curtis's character's early college graduation. The costume aspect means the killer dons multiple masks throughout the night as the booze and drugs flow, much the chagrin of the train conductors. The murderer is revealed to be a one-time pledge who was hospitalized after having a psychotic break during a hazing prank. Terror Train and Halloween demonstrate an evolution of the slasher killer, the escaped convict or mental patient trope that preys on existing cultural anxieties. Beginning in the 1960s, awareness about mental health problems and criminal behavior grew. Patients were often wrongly demonized in the media. Slashers are certainly good at turning so-called safe spaces dangerous, like summer camp, school dances, or your own home. The 1980s slasher moved into suburbia. Films like Halloween and Slumber Party Massacre were set in suburban neighborhoods, challenging the idea that middle-class spaces were safe. The threat is close to home and more familiar. In the 1980s, Americans were starting to see their socioeconomic middle-class safety wasn't all that safe. The slasher painted that metaphor. Many slasher victims were middle-class, a metaphor for a false sense of security their socioeconomic status could afford. The slasher may have found its stride in the 80s, but there was a critical and moral outcry against slasher films as they grew in popularity. Critics and the public alike complained that the films were misogynistic and promoted violence against women. Are there problematic elements to some of these movies? Yes. But it's a misconception of the genre that being a woman, a person of color, or queer automatically means you won't make it to the end. The fact is, anyone and everyone can die in a slasher. Contrary to popular belief, male characters are not only more likely to die, but their deaths are more likely to be much more graphic. During this slasher boom, the general outline was cemented, and we start to see creators playing with the rules and challenging expectations. As franchises developed, releasing sequel after sequel necessitated creative approaches to how and why a killer would return. And new properties needed freshness to draw audiences to them. Enter the supernatural and sequel phase. The iconic example, Nightmare on Elm Street. The 1984 film introduces Freddy Krueger.
Who are you?
The demonically powered spirit entity of a child killer who can enter the dreams of his victims and cause them very real harm.
This is just a dream, he isn't real!
Freddy marks the beginning of a new supernatural trend in slashers. Slashers also brought in elements like telepathy, resurrected spirits, and demonic possession.
Hi, I'm Chucky, wanna play?
Child's Play gave us a killer doll possessed by the soul of a serial killer. In Killer Party, the vengeful spirit of a deceased frat pledge possesses and kills a new batch of Greek life recruits.
I've been waiting 20 years for this.
In Shocker, a serial killer makes a deal with the devil that turns him into pure, murderous electricity.
Give it to me!
Capable of possessing other people. What else was going on during the shift to the supernatural? The Satanic Panic. Satanic panic was the term coined to define the public hysteria in the U.S. that led to a dramatic spike in allegations of occultism, ritual abuse, and demonic worship.
Dungeons and Dragons has been called the most effective introduction to the occult.
Sensationalist media and religious fundamentalism fueled the craze.
We have all types of perversion going on, and it's affecting America.
Some psychologists, psychiatrists, political, and religious leaders were quick to point fingers at things like Dungeons and Dragons, heavy metal music, television, and movies, including slashers. They claimed these depictions encouraged demonic rituals and belief in the devil. They also failed to realize that doing so made them kind of cool in a rebellious way.
Teenagers who flock to heavy metal concerts flash this sign often.
Something that can be said of the slasher itself. Sequels often also came to depend on the supernatural to explain the killer's return.
Freddy's home.
The continued financial success of the movies meant that they had to bring killers back again and again. And sometimes their weapons came back with them, like Freddy's unique and specific twist on the trope. Rule 8, slashing or cutting weapon. Killers and slashers seem to favor a weapon with a sharp edge. Like a knife, machete, arrow, chainsaw, broken bottle, or even a pitchfork. Of course, there's always exceptions to the rule. Good old bare hands will do in a pinch, and there's plenty of that as well. But in Freddy's case, a very distinctive bladed glove sets him apart. Bladed weapons are so key to the slasher that they are often featured heavily in the movie posters. Nightmare on Elm Street director Wes Craven conceptualized Freddy as the savage side of male adulthood. The sharp-edged weapon, which can be read as a phallic symbol, highlights this. At its core, Nightmare on Elm Street is about repression. Freddy is a predator who was, and still is, unable to repress his sexual and violent urges. The adults try to suppress the threat to their children by murdering Freddy and covering up their involvement.
He's dead, honey, because Mommy killed him.
Freddy also runs on fear. Literally, it's how he has his powers. So he's motivated to keep causing nightmares even as the victims attempt to repress sleep. Then there's the plot in Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which is often seen as a metaphor for queer repression. Nancy, Nightmare's main character and final survivor, refuses to let things stay in the past. She pressures her parents for answers and tries to help her friends survive.
Fred Krueger! Do you know who that is, Mother?
Even when security bars are put on her house and her boyfriend is killed across the street, she cleverly draws Freddy out of her dreams and into her world, setting booby traps. She's a new iteration of another time-tested trope. Rule 9, the final girl. Often, only a single survivor or survivor duo is left. Most often, the so-called final girl, who is resourceful and virtuous. She's often the first to note that something is amiss. Coined by Carol Clover and Men, Women, and Chainsaws, the final girl allegedly reinforces current attitudes about sex and gender. She's often a virgin or sexually unavailable and vice-free, doesn't smoke, drink, or do drugs. They might wield weapons and even defeat the killer, but they frequently do so haphazardly and while screaming. Lori from Halloween fits this definition like a glove, at first. Her reluctance to talk about boys, non-existent sex life, and goody-two-shoes personality.
What are you going to wear to the dance tomorrow night? I didn't know you thought about things like that, Lori.
According to Carpenter himself, actually makes Lori the most sexually frustrated character. This is a trait both she and the killer Michael share. Carpenter points out Lori chooses phallic objects to stab her attacker. The idea that the killer becomes a penetrated victim makes the final girl and the slasher equal. Even when movies make it a point to try and make villain and victim as different as possible, it is still a fact that to survive these movies, you need to kill or at least fight back. The cycle of violence goes on and on. Nancy paves the way for a line of strong final girls and final guy in the Nightmare series, each surviving long enough to train an even more formidable successor. Rather than undermining the power or strength of women, as some critics of the slasher genre assert, the final girl trope as embodied by the Nightmare franchise can actually show an empowering universe where survival is dependent on a system of female education. Why this new crop of more formidable and self-assured final girls? Well, it's in part a response to the public and critical outcry for stronger female characters in horror. The 1980s was a formidable decade for women's rights in America, but there could be another reason at play.
Before even the term slasher film was coined, there were a number of films that were being responded to critically as being horror films that involved killers stalking especially women, and they were dubbed at the time by the critics Siskel and Ebert women in danger films, and they were being largely responded to as if they were misogynistic. Some of that complaint stems from the particular political moment of the late 1970s and into the early 1980s, which was informed by the rise of second wave feminism in public discourse and the backlash against that rise of second wave feminism. And to some extent, I think these films of the period were exploiting some of that political interest, either because the films that were being picked up for production or distribution were the kinds of films that were investigating these kind of misogynistic representations.
All of you are very pretty.
Please don't do this.
I love you.
Potentially because it would just attract audience interest.
The supernatural and sequel period of the mid-80s continued into the 90s, and by this point, there was no denying the slasher's firm grip on pop culture. They had formulas. Their predictability can be comforting and even gratifying, at least for some. You know what you're going to get, but after a while, that tends to get not only a little repetitive, but a little boring. That gave room for a new twist, the postmodern slasher. Beginning in the mid-1990s, we see a wave of slashers that are intertextual and self-referential. Past ideas and past tropes are unreliable at best and dangerous at worst, as in relying on them can lead to your death.
Dylan, what's the matter?
By 1994, Craven came back to the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise with New Nightmare. He needed to both appease Nightmare fans while also offering them something new. So Craven decided to include that into the story.
This is still a script we're talking about, right, Wes?
The main character is the actress who played Nancy from earlier films, Heather Langenkamp, who plays herself.
I think that only happens in the movies.
So we've got Heather playing herself, playing Nancy.
What kind of choice?
Whether or not you're willing to play Nancy.
Robert Englund, the actor behind Freddy Krueger, plays himself. Add in obsessed fans, nods to the older movies, and a new killer, an ancient supernatural entity who is trapped in the nightmare films themselves. It's all very meta and tongue-in-cheek. Heather defeats the killer by embracing her history as Nancy. She becomes a real-life, fictional final girl. During this time, younger audiences were more cynical and media savvy, so filmmakers found new ways to lean on preconceived notions about slasher films to circumvent the audience's expectations. Again, it was Craven who used that established formula to create something entirely new with his next film, Scream. Released in 1996, Scream is basically a slasher about slashers.
Hello?
And a hallmark of the postmodern period.
Who is this?
In this cinematic universe, slasher films that exist in our world exist as movies in theirs, and it uses the audience's knowledge of the subgenre in a satirical way.
You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
The movie starts with mass killer Ghostface prank calling his first victim.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Halloween. You know, the one with the guy in the white mask who walks around and stalks babysitters.
Who then proceeds to die in part because she doesn't know the answers to his horror movie trivia.
They're films that are defined by explicit reflection on the subgenre, its tropes and traits, using sardonic comedy, and using a lot of intertextual references to refer back to the subgenre's past.
Not only does the film kill off one of its most famous faces in the first act, it lets the audience know this is a movie for slasher fans. Another big twist to the established trope is that the killer is really two people. It also gives us two final girls, both of whom must rely on each other in the film and its subsequent sequels to survive. It's a cool twist on the women educating other women theme from Nightmare and other slashers. While postmodern slashers worked hard to circumvent audience expectations, there was still a desire for more nostalgic slasher films. The late 90s gave us a return to the strictly human slasher killer, like in I Know What You Did Last Summer and Urban Legend. Nostalgic slashers grew with the success of the new postmodern wave, driving numerous franchise reboots at the start of the new century. Remakes of older slasher films and franchises following the attacks of 9/11 and other terrorist events was perhaps fueled by the desire to return nostalgically to the past. It gave creators the chance to tackle the tropes and themes of the subgenre with a fresh take and new social commentary. This becomes even more relevant in our neo-slasher phase. 2006's Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon is a great example of the new crop of slashers. Picking up on the mockumentary horror trend that would become popular in the 21st century, it's a story about a regular serial killer-obsessed person becoming a mass slasher himself, as a documentary crew follows his journey. It's all about the role journalism should play in capturing violent media, how desire for fame can propel one to do bad things, and how easy it is to get caught up in tropes. Plus, it has someone get their heart ripped out and another having their head crushed in an apple press. Rule number 10, creative and gory kills. One of the reasons people check out slashers is for the kills. It's about the pitchfork impalements, a well-thrown hatchet, a literal deathbed, or a good old-fashioned knife stab. The elaborate and creative, sometimes ridiculous kills have always been a central part of the appeal of the slasher film. Today's neo-slasher period takes the creative and gory kills to new heights. With decades of movies to pay homage to and the advancement of special effects and CGI, filmmakers aren't as limited as they were in the past. A head split down the middle by a bread slicer, a rather creative use of a blender, heads turned into jack-o'-lanterns. These films still include established slasher tropes, but often it's with a twist. Take the use of the supernatural, for example. We still get spirit possession, but we also get literal space-time travel or reliving past events Groundhog Day style. There are cameras everywhere now, and we never quite know when and if we are being watched, or by who. So we've also moved away from the POV of the proto-slasher in favor of long tracking shots of the killer stalking their victims. It's less about putting ourselves in the slasher's shoes and more about the sense of foreboding. The typical suburban settings of the 80s and 90s make way for the more common urban setting. Attacks often happen in public spaces, with witnesses. Death counts are also higher. The final girl shifts from a passive survivor to an active hero. This is not just because they are responding to current events, but because the audience is aware and fed up with the stereotypes. The new final person reflects this as well. and benefits from the collective wisdom of the survivors before them, emphasizing how education and historical understanding, as well as adopting perspectives other than your own, are critical. The Scream franchise reboot and Netflix Fear Street series, for example, both have diverse casts of final people who rely on their friendships and knowledge of the past to survive.
We've moved towards a new emphasis on sincerity, on optimism in the face of crisis, and an emphasis on felt experience. That's coupled with a desire to push the subgenre forward, to recognise that originality is still possible and that we can usefully play with conventions in a way that drives innovation.
New slashers still explore themes of mental health, but this time it's through the victims. These slashers address the PTSD the final person faces and how their experiences transform the lives of those around them. Even popular rebooted franchises like Halloween and Scream do this obviously and intentionally. Despite what some critics might tell you, the slasher subgenre is not just alive and well, it's thriving. Perhaps now more than ever, slashers aren't confined to movies anymore. There are a few examples of comics, books, and games adapting the subgenre previously, but nothing like what we're seeing now. There are even slasher video games that allow you to play not just as potential victims, but as the killer themselves. Fans can live out their own slasher movie without being in any real danger, speaking again to the cathartic elements of the subgenre.
The biggest thing for me when it comes to the influences of slasher films is community. It's been about fandom. It's about finding other people who are very much like you at horror conventions, online message boards, social media. It's been the people you can connect to that are just as nerdy about this thing as you are.
Why else do we love slashers? Some claim they're cathartic. Others say they serve as condemnation of sexuality, represent castration anxiety, or even evoke the instability and fear of entering adulthood. They can represent the death of the American dream, serve as allegory for trauma, act as modern fairy tales, or critique supposedly protective institutions. They horrify and stimulate, but they can educate us. They remind us that danger exists, but teach us how to survive. The slasher is cautionary, cathartic, sensational, and educational. And freaking fun.